The phenomenon of gloom enduring for years impressed itself on the memory of the 12 tribes and is mentioned in many passages of the Bible. Thou hast covered us with the shadow of death. Psalms 44:19. The people that walked in darkness, in the land of the shadow of death. Isaiah 9:2. The Israelites wandered in the wilderness in a solitary way. Hungry and thirsty, their soul fainted in them, and the Lord brought them out of darkness and the shadow of death. Psalms 107. The terrors of the shadow of death. Job 24:17. In Job 38 the Lord speaks, "Who shut up the sea with doors, barriers, when it break forth? When I made the cloud the garment thereof, and thick darkness a swaddling band for it, and caused the dayspring to know his place, that it might take hold of the ends of the earth, that the wicked might be shaken out of it." The low and slowly drifting clouds enshrouded the wanderers in the desert. These clouds dimly glowed at night, their upper portion reflected the sunlight. The glow being pale during the day and red after sunset, the Israelites were able to distinguish between day and night. They were protected by the clouds from the sun during the wandering in the desert, and according to the Midrashic literature, they saw sun and moon for the first time only at the end of the wandering. The clouds that covered the desert during the wandering of the 12 tribes were called a celestial garment or clouds of glory. He spread a cloud for a covering, and fire to give light in the night, and the cloud of the Lord was upon them by day. For days or months the cloud tarried in one place, and the Israelites journeyed not, but when the cloud moved, the wanderers followed it, and revered it because of its celestial origin. In Arabic sources, too, we read that the Amalekites, who left Hedjaz because of plagues, followed the cloud in their wandering through the desert. On their way to Palestine and Egypt they met the Israelites, and in the battles between them the screen of clouds played an important part. Nihongi, a chronicle of Japan from the earliest period, refers to a time when there was continuous darkness and no difference of day and night. It describes in the name of the Emperor Kami Yamato an ancient time when the world was given over to widespread desolation. It was an age of darkness and disorder. In this gloom Hiko Hono Ninigi no Mikoto fostered justice, and so governed this western border. In China the annals telling of the time of the Emperor Yu refer to the Valley of Obscurity and to the somber residence as places of astronomical observations. The name Shadow of Death expresses the influence of the sunless gloom upon the life processes. The Chinese annals of Wang Shixing, in the chapter dealing with the ten stems, the ten stages of the earth's primeval history, relate that at Wu, the sixth stem, darkness destroys the growth of all things. Buddhist scholars declare that with the beginning of the sixth world age or sun, the whole world becomes filled with smoke and saturated with greasiness of that smoke. There is no distinction of day and night. The gloom is caused by a cycle-destroying great cloud of cosmic origin and dimensions. On the Samoan Islands the Aborigines narrate, "Then arose smell. The smell became smoke, which again became clouds. The sea too arose, and in a stupendous catastrophe of nature the land sank into the sea. The new earth, the Samoan Islands, arose out of the womb of the last earth. In the darkness that enveloped the world, the islands of Tonga, Samoa, Rotuma, Fiji, and Uva, Wallace Island, and Fortuna rose from the bottom of the ocean." Ancient rhymes of the inhabitants of Hawaii refer to a prolonged darkness. The earth is dancing. Let darkness cease. The heavens are enclosing. Finished is the world of Hawaii. The Quiche tribe migrated to Mexico, the Israelites roamed in the desert, the Amalekites migrated toward Palestine and Egypt, an uneasy movement took place in all corners of the ruined world. The migration in central Polynesia, shrouded in gloom, is narrated in the traditions of the aborigines of this part of the world about a chief named Dili who lived long in utter darkness in Avaki, who migrated in a canoe named Weary of Darkness to find a land of light, and who, after many years of wandering, saw the sky clearing little by little and arrived at a region where they could see each other clearly. In the Kalevala, the Finnish epos which dates back to an enormous antiquity, 31 the time when the sun and moon disappeared from the sky, and dreaded shadows covered it, is described in these words, "Even birds grew sick and perished, men and maidens, faint and famished, perished in the cold and darkness, from the absence of the sunshine, from the absence of the moonlight. But the wise men of the Northland could not know the dawn of morning, for the moon shines not in season nor appears the sun at midday, from their stations in the sky vault. An explanation which would rationalize this picture as the description of a seasonal long night in northern regions will stumble over the second part of the passage. The seasons did not return in their wonted order. The dreaded shadow covered the earth when Ukko, the highest of the Finnish deities, relinquished the support of the heavens. Hailstones of iron rained down furiously, and then the world became shrouded in a generation-long darkness. This twilight of the gods of the Nordic races is but the shadow of death of the scriptures. The entire generation of those who left Egypt perished in the lightless desert. Vegetation died in the catastrophe. The Iranian Book of Bundahees says, blight was diffused over the vegetation, and it withered away immediately. 33 When the sky was shattered, the day became dark, and the earth teemed with noxious creatures. For a long time there was no green thing seen. Seeds would not germinate in a sunless world. It took many years before the earth again brought forth vegetation. This is told in the written and oral traditions of many peoples. According to American sources, the regeneration of the world and of humankind took place under the veil of the gloomy shadows, and the time is indicated as the end of the 15th year of the darkness, 10 years before the end of the gloom. 34 In the scriptural narration, it was probably the day when Aaron's dried twig budded for the first time. The eerie world, dark and groaning, was unpleasant to all the senses save the sense of smell. The world was fragrant. When the breeze blew, the clouds conveyed a sweet odor. In the papyrus Anastasi 4, written in the year of misery, in which it is said that the months are reversed, the planet god is described as arriving with the sweet wind before him. In a similar text of the Hebrews we read that the times and seasons were confused, and a fragrance perfumed all the world, and the perfume was brought by the pillar of smoke. The fragrance was like that of myrrh and frankincense. Israel was surrounded by clouds, and as soon as the clouds were set in motion, the winds breathed myrrh and frankincense. The Vedas contain hymns to Agni which glows from the sky. Its fragrance became the fragrance of the earth. That fragrance of thine, which the immortals of yore gathered up. The generation of those days, when the star conveyed its fragrance to men on the earth, is immortalized in the tradition of the Hindus. The Vedic hymn compares the fragrance of the star Agni to the scent of the lotus. Ambrosia. In what way did this veil of gloom dissolve itself? When the air is overcharged with vapor, dew, rain, hail, or snow falls, most probably the atmosphere discharged its compounds, presumably of carbon and hydrogen, in a similar way. Has any testimony been preserved that during the many years of gloom carbohydrates precipitated? When the dew fell upon the camp in the night, the manna fell upon it, it was like the hoar frost on the ground. It had the shape of coriander seed, the yellowish color of bdellium, and an oily taste like honeycomb. It was called corn of heaven and it was ground between stones and baked in pans. The manna fell from the clouds. After the nightly cooling, the carbohydrates precipitated and fell with the morning dew. The grains dissolved in the heat and evaporated, but in a closed vessel the substance could be preserved for a long time. The exegetes have endeavored to explain the phenomenon of manna and were helped by the naturalists who discovered that a tamarisk in the desert of Sinai sheds its seeds during certain months of the year. 4 But why should this seed be called corn of heaven, bread of heaven? 5 Or why should it be said it will rain bread from heaven? It is also not easy to explain how a multitude of men and animals could have existed for many years in a wilderness on the scarce and seasonal seeds of some desert plant. Were such a thing possible, the desert would be preferable to tillable land that yields bread to the laborer only in the sweat of his brow. The clouds brought the heavenly bread, it is also said in the Talmud. 7 But if the manna fell from clouds that enveloped the entire world, it must have fallen not only in the desert of wanderings, but everywhere, and not only the Israelites, but other peoples, too, must have tasted it and spoken of it in their traditions. There was a world fire, says the Icelandic tradition, followed by the Fimbul winter, and only one human pair remained alive in the north. This human pair lie hidden in the hole during the fire of St. Then came the terrible Fimbul winter at the end of the world, age. Meanwhile they feed on morning dew, and from them come the folk who people the renewed earth. Three elements are connected in the Icelandic tradition, which are the same three we met in the Israelite tradition: the world fire, the dark winter that endured many years, and the morning dew that served as food during these years of gloom when nothing budded. The Maoris of New Zealand tell of fiery winds and fierce clouds that lashed the waters into tidal waves that touched the sky and were accompanied by furious hailstorms. The ocean fled. The progeny of the storm and hail were mist, and heavy dew and light dew. After the catastrophe, but little of the dry land was left standing above the sea. Then clear light increased in the world, and the beings who had been hidden between sky and earth, before they were parted, now multiplied upon the earth. This tradition of the Maoris had substantially the same elements as the Israelite tradition. The destruction of the world was accompanied by hurricanes, hail, meteorites, and sky-high billows. The land submerged, a mist covered the earth for a long time, heavy dew fell to the ground together with light dew, as in the passage quoted from Numbers 11:9. The writings of Buddhism relate that when a world cycle comes to an end with the world destroyed and the ocean dried up, there is no distinction of day and night, and heavenly ambrosia serves as food. In the hymns of Rig Veda 11 it is said that honey, madhu, comes from the clouds. These clouds originated from the pillar of cloud. Among the hymns of the Atharva Veda there is one to the honey lash, from heaven, from earth, from the atmosphere, from the sea, from the fire, and from the wind. The honey lash hath verily sprung. This, clothed in amrite, ambrosia, all the creatures revering, acclaim in their hearts. The Egyptian Book of the Dead speaks of the divine clouds and the great dew that bring the earth into contact with the heavens. The Greeks called the heavenly bread ambrosia. It is described by the Greek poets in identical terms with manna. It had the taste of honey and a fragrance. This heavenly bread has given classical scholars many headaches. Greek authors from Homer and Hesiod down through the ages continually referred to ambrosia as the heavenly food, which in its fluid state is called nectar. But it was used also as ointment. 15. It had the fragrance of a lily, and as food for the horses of Hera when she visited Zeus in the sky. Hera, Earth, was veiled in it when she hurried from her brother Ares, Mars, to Zeus, Jupiter. What could it be? This heavenly bread, which served also as a veil for a goddess planet, and was used as an ointment, too? It was honey, said some scholars. But honey is a regular food for mortals, whereas ambrosia was given only to the generation of heroes. Then what was this substance that served as fodder on the ground for horses, as a veil for planets, bread from the sky for heroes, and that also turned fluid for their drink, and was oil and perfume for ointments? It was the manna that was baked into bread, had an oily taste and also a honey taste, was found on the ground by man and beast, wrapped the earth and the heavenly bodies in a veil, was called corn of heaven and bread of the mighty. One tea had a fragrant odor, and served the women in the wilderness as ointment. 18 Manna, like ambrosia, was compared with honey and with morning dew. The belief of Aristotle and other writers. 19 That honey falls from the atmosphere with the dew was based on the experience of those days when the world was veiled in the carbon clouds that precipitated honey frost. These clouds are described as dreaded shades in the Kalevala. From these dreaded shades, says the epos, honey dropped. And the clouds their fragrance sifted, sifted honey. From their home within the heavens, the Maoris in the Pacific, the Jews on the border of Asia and Africa, the Hindus, the Finns, the Icelanders, all describe the honey food being dropped from the clouds, dreary shades of the shadow of death, that enveloped the earth after a cosmic catastrophe. All traditions agree also that the source of the heavenly bread falling from the clouds with the morning dew was a celestial body. The Sibyl says that the sweet heavenly bread came from the starry heavens. The planet Goduko, or Jupiter, is said to have been the source of the honey that dropped from the clouds. 22 Athena covered other planet goddesses with a robe ambrosial, and provided nectar and ambrosia to the heroes. 23 Other traditions, too, See the origin of the honeydew in a celestial body that enveloped the earth in clouds. For this reason ambrosia or manna is called heavenly bread. Rivers of milk and honey. The honey frost fell in enormous quantities. The Haggadic literature says that the quantity which fell every day would have sufficed to nourish the people for 2,000 years. One, all the peoples of the east and the west could see it. A few hours after the break of day, the heat under the cloud cover liquefied the grains and volatilized them. The ground absorbed some of the liquefied mass, as it absorbs dew. The grains also fell upon the water, and the rivers became milky in appearance. The Egyptians relate that the Nile flowed for a time blended with honey. For the strange appearance of the rivers of Palestine, in the desert the Israelites saw no river, caused the scouts who returned from a survey of the land to call it the land that floweth with milk and honey. Numbers 13, 27. The heavens rain oil, the wadis run with honey, says a text found in Ras Shamra, Ugarit, in Syria. In the rabbinical literature it is said that melting of manna formed streams that furnished drink to many deer and other animals. The Atharva Vedahim say that honey lash came down from fire and wind, ambrosia fell, and streams of honey flowed upon the earth. The broad earth shall milk for us precious honey. It shall pour out milk for us in rich streams. The Finnish tradition narrates that land and water were covered successively by black, red, and white milk. The first and second were the colors of the substances, ashes and blood, that constituted the plagues, Exodus 7 and 9. The last one was the color of ambrosia that turned into nectar on land and water. A memory of a time when streams of milk and streams of sweet nectar flowed is also preserved in Ovid, Jericho. The earth's crust trembled and cracked again and again as its strata settled after the major displacement. Chasms opened up, springs disappeared, and new springs appeared. When the Israelites approached the River Jordan, a slice of one bank fell, blocking the stream long enough for the tribes to cross over. The waters which came down from above stood and rose up upon a heap very far from the city Adam, that is beside Zaten, and those that came down toward the sea of the plain, even the salt sea, failed, and were cut off, and the people passed over right against Jericho. A similar occurrence took place on the 8th of December, 1267, when the Jordan was dammed for 16 hours, and again following the earthquake of 1927, when a slice of one bank fell into the river not far from Adam and blocked the water for over 21 hours. At Dame, Adam, the people crossed the river on its dry bed. The fall of the walls of Jericho at the blast of the trumpets is a well-known episode, but it is not well interpreted. The horns blown by the priests for 7 days played no greater natural role than Moses' rod with which, in the legend, he opened a passage in the sea. When the people heard the sound of the trumpet, it happened that the wall fell down flat. The great sound of the trumpet was produced by the earth. The Israelite tribes, believing in magic, thought that the sound of the earth came in response to the blowing of the ram's horns for 7 days. The great walls of Jericho, they were 12 feet wide, have been excavated. They were found to have been destroyed by an earthquake. The archaeological evidences also prove that these walls collapsed at the beginning of the Hyksos period, or shortly after the close of the Middle Kingdom. The earth had not yet recovered from the previous world catastrophe, and reacted with continuous tremors when the hour of a new cosmic disaster approached, the event we described at the beginning of this book only to go back to the cataclysm of the Exodus, the upheaval of the days of Joshua, when the earth stood still on the day of the battle at Beth Horan. Chapter 7, Stones Suspended in the Air. The hot hailstones which, at Moses' intercession, had remained suspended in the air when they were about to fall upon the Egyptians, were now cast down upon the Canaanites. These words mean that a part of the meteorites of the cometary train of the days of Exodus remained in the celestial sphere for about 50 years, falling in the days of Joshua, in the valley of Beth-horon, on the same forenoon when the sun and the moon stood still for the length of a full day. The language of the Talmud and Midrash suggests that the same comet returned after some 50 years. Once more it passed very close to the earth. This time it did not reverse the poles of the earth, but kept the terrestrial axis tilted for a considerable length of time. Again the world was, in the language of the rabbis, consumed in the whirlwind, and all the kingdoms dotted the earth quaked and trembled from the noise of thunder. Terrified mankind was decimated once more, and carcasses were like rubbish in this day of anger. On the day when this took place on the earth, the sky was in confusion. Stones fell from the heavens, sun and moon stopped in their paths, and a comet must also have been seen. Habakkuk describes the portent in the sky on that memorable day when, in his words, the sun and moon stood still in their habitation. It had the form of a man on a chariot drawn by horses and was regarded as God's angel. In the King James Version the passages read, "His glory covered the heavens, and his brightness was as the light, he had horns coming out of his hand. Burning coals went forth at his feet. He drove asunder the nations, and the everlasting mountains were scattered. Was thine anger against the rivers? Was thy wrath against the sea, that thou didst ride upon thine horses and thy chariots of salvation? Thou didst cleave the earth with rivers. The mountains saw thee, and they trembled. The overflowing of the water passed by, the deep uttered his voice. The sun and moon stood still in their habitation, at the light of thy arrows they went, and at the shining of thy glittering spear. Thou didst march through the land in indignation, thou didst thresh the heathen in anger. Thou didst walk through the sea with thine horses, through the heap of great waters." Since the texts of the scriptures have, for some psychological reason rooted in the readers, the quality of being easily misread, misunderstood, or misinterpreted, I give also some of the passages of the third chapter of Habakkuk in another, modernized reading: "His splendor over all the sky, his glory filling all the earth, his radiance is a lightning blaze, on either side flash rays. At his step the earth is shaken, at his look nations are scattered. The ancient hills are shattered, mountains of old sink low. Art thou wrathful at the sea, that thou art storming on the steeds, upon the chariots in triumph? The hills writhe at thy sight. The sun forgets to rise, the moon to move, before the flashes of thy darting arrows, before the sheen of thy lightning, thy lance. Thou trampest earth in fury, thou art threshing the peoples in thine anger. With the earth disturbed in its spinning on its axis, the mechanical friction of displaced strata and magma must have set the world on fire. The world burned." The Greek story of Phathon will be introduced here because of the interpretation heard by Solon during his visit to Egypt. Phathon. The Greeks as well as the Carians and other peoples on the shores of the Aegean Sea told of a time when the sun was driven off its course and disappeared for an entire day, and the earth was burned and drowned. The Greek legend says that the young Phathon, who claimed parentage of the sun, on that fatal day tried to drive the chariot of the sun. Phathon was unable to make his way against the whirling poles, and their swift axis swept him away. Phathon in Greek means the blazing one. Many authors have dealt with the story of Phathon. The best known version is a creation of the Latin poet Ovid. The chariot of the sun, driven by Phathon, moved no longer in the same course as before. The horses break loose from their course and rush aimlessly, knocking against the stars set deep in the sky and snatching the chariot along through uncharted ways. The constellations of the cold bears tried to plunge into the forbidden sea, and the sun's chariot roamed through unknown regions of the air. It was borne along just as a ship driven before the headlong blast, whose pilot has let the useless rudder go and abandoned the ship to the gods and prayers. The earth bursts into flame, the highest parts first, and splits into deep cracks, and its moisture is all dried up. The meadows are burned to white ashes, the trees are consumed, green leaves and all, and the ripe grain furnishes fuel for its own destruction. Great cities perish with their walls, and the vast conflagration reduces whole nations to ashes. The woods are ablaze with the mountains. Etna is blazing boundlessly. And twin-peaked Parnassus. Nor does its chilling clime save Scythia, Caucasus burns. And the heaven-piercing Alps and cloud-capped Apennines. The scorched clouds belched forth smoke. Phathon sees the earth aflame. He can no longer bear the ashes and whirling sparks, and is completely shrouded in the dense, hot smoke. In this pitchy darkness he cannot tell where he is or whither he is going. It was then, as men think, that the peoples of Ethiopia became black-skinned, since the blood was drawn to the surface of their bodies by the heat. Then also Libya became a desert, for the heat dried up her moisture. The Dun's waters steam, Babylonian Euphrates burns, the Ganges, Phasis, Danube, Alpheus boil, Spcheios banks are aflame. The golden sands of Tagus melt in the intense heat, and the swans are scorched. The Nile fled in terror to the ends of the earth. The seven mouths lie empty, filled with dust, seven broad channels, all without a stream. The same mischance dries up the Thracian rivers, Pibras and Strymon, also the rivers of the west, the Rhine, Rhone, Po and the Tiber. Great cracks yawn everywhere. Even the sea shrinks up, and what was but now a great watery expanse is a dry plain of sand. The mountains, which the deep sea had covered before, spring forth, and increase the numbers of the scattered Cyclades. How could the poets have known that a change in the movement of the sun across the firmament must cause a world conflagration, blazing of volcanoes, boiling of rivers, disappearance of seas, birth of deserts, emergence of islands, if the sun never changed its harmonious journey from sunrise to sunset? The disturbance in the movement of the sun was followed by a period as long as a day, when the sun did not appear at all. Ovid continues, if we are to believe report, one whole day went without the sun. Too, but the burning world gave light. A prolonged night in one part of the world must be accompanied by a prolonged day in another part. In Ovid we see the phenomenon related in the Book of Joshua, but from another longitude. This may seem odo credimus. Erna mis diem sine sol ferunt. Stimulate surmise as to the geographical origin of the Indo-Iranian or Carian migrants to Greece. The globe changed the inclination of its axis, latitudes changed, too. Ovid ends the description of the world catastrophe contained in the story of Phaethon, causing all things to shake with her mighty trembling. She, the earth, sank back a little lower than her wonted place. Plato recorded the story heard to generations before from Solon, the wise ruler of Athens. Solon, on his visit to Egypt, questioned the priests, versed in the lore of antiquity, on early history. He discovered that neither he himself nor any other Greek knew anything at all, one might say, about such matters. Solon unfolded before the priests the tale of the deluge, the only ancient tradition he was aware of. One of the priests, an old man, said, "There have been and there will be many and divers destructions of mankind, of which the greatest are by fire and water, and lesser ones by countless other means. For in truth the story that is told in your country, as well as ours, how once upon a time Phaethon, son of Helios, yoked his father's chariot, and, because he was unable to drive it along the course taken by his father, burnt up all that was upon the earth and himself perished by a thunderbolt," that story, as it is told, has the fashion of a legend, but the truth of it lies in the occurrence of a shifting of the bodies in the heavens which move around the earth, and a destruction of the things on the earth by fierce fire, which recurs at long intervals. The Egyptian priest explained to Solon that in these catastrophes the literary works of many peoples and their learned men perished, for that reason the Greeks were still childish, as they no longer knew the true horrors of the past. These words of the priest were only an introduction to a revelation of his knowledge about lands that were erased when Greece also in Plato Timaeus, the entire world were visited with heavenly wrath. He told the story of mighty kingdom on a great island in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean that submerged and sank forever into its waters. Atlantis. The story narrated by Plato of the island of Atlantis that ruled Africa as far as the border of Egypt and Europe as far as Tuscany on the Apennine Peninsula, and that in one fatal night was shattered by earthquakes and sank, never ceased to occupy the imagination of the literati. Strabo and Pliny thought that the story of Atlantis was an illusion of the elderly Plato. But to this day the tradition, as revived by Plato, has not died. Poets and novelists have exploited the story freely, scientists have done so with caution. An incomplete catalogue of the literature on Atlantis in 1926 included 1,700 titles. One, although Plato said clearly that Atlantis was situated behind the Pillars of Hercules, Gibraltar, in the Atlantic Ocean, as is also indicated by the name of the island. Travelers and other guesses have placed to Atlantis in all parts of the world, even on dry land, as, for example, in Tunisia, to Palestine, and South America.